I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young is off today.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush is promising to stay the course in Iraq. Yesterday, the president said American troops would not withdraw until Iraq is a free country run by the Iraqi people, and that U.S. forces there are plenty tough to withstand any attacks against them. Well, meantime, in Iraq, the violence continues. 10 U.S. soldiers were wounded in 3 separate attacks today. 2 Iraqis were killed and several others wounded. Anger at American troops has been high, especially in Fallujah, where an explosion at a mosque this week killed at least 10 people. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Washington Post reporter Anthony Shadid. And Anthony, we're hearing from the U.S. military now that the explosion was actually a bomb-making class?
That's right. There was a lot of debate at the scene of the explosion. Residents accused the Americans of bombing the place or firing a missile at the mosque. Some residents more privately suggested that there was bomb-making going on inside there. When you talk to the relatives of the people who were there, it sounds like something was going on inside, bomb manufacturing. It also sounds like these were religious students and that they'd been together for up to a year, and they were drawn to the preacher who was there, and he was fiercely opposed to the occupation and had made that clear several times in sermons on Friday.
And this was Laith Khalil. Tell us a little bit more about him.
He's a 35-year-old preacher. He was apparently educated in Islamic Law College in Ramadi. He was charismatic by all accounts. The U.S. military in Fallujah was aware of what he was saying. They described him as probably one of the more militant of the preachers in that city. There was no evidence until now that it was anything beyond rhetorical, that he was actually trying to somehow plot attacks against Americans.
And speaking of that, what's the evidence now that there are increased activities in terms of a guerrilla campaign to get U.S. and British forces out of Iraq?
There's a little bit of debate about what is the scope of that guerrilla campaign. It's clear that there are daily hit-and-run attacks, ambushes going on inside the capital, inside Baghdad, and also to the north and to the west. The U.S. military has pretty consistently described these as what they call diehard remnants of Saddam Hussein's regime. There's some evidence, like what we saw in Fallujah the other day, that resistance might be broadened somehow, that it might be people disenchanted about the direction of the occupation or also Islamic activists who are opposed to the U.S. occupation on more religious grounds.
Is there any way to know, Anthony, whether these are people who were former Saddam supporters who aren't happy about what's happening there, or Islamic activists who simply want to make sure that they will be in charge as time goes on?
Well, the sense that you get here now is that it is mostly carried out by remnants of the regime. There is a certain sophistication in the attacks. According to U.S. military officials, they're carried out by groups of 5 to 7 people. They show some kind of training. They don't see any signs of central coordination, in other words, coordination across, from city to city. Paul Bremer, the U.S. administrator here, suggested that there were people inside Iraq with ties to Iran, Al-Qaeda, other countries. We really haven't seen any evidence of that so far.
And as I'm sure you know, President Bush yesterday said to the militants who've been attacking U.S. troops, bring them on. How's that likely to be heard where you are in Baghdad?
It probably would continue regardless of what Bush says. I think the idea is, of the people staging these attacks is to make this occupation so costly that the Americans eventually withdraw.
Well, are you seeing these as really isolated events? I mean, what's the feeling you get on the ground? Are most people still relatively pleased that U.S. troops are there and trying to restore order? Or is there really a widespread feeling of disaffection with the military?
It's a good question. I think you see, a whole spectrum of opinions on this. I don't think... Yeah, at least in talking to Iraqis, there seems to be a little bit of anxiety over these attacks, in the sense that if the attacks continue, the American crackdown will probably be even fiercer, and that the place could spiral into more violence. And I don't think there's many people in this country that want to see that. On the other hand, there's deep frustration with the pace of the reconstruction, and the Americans are not popular today in Baghdad. People are very upset and frustrated about the lack of electricity, lack of water, and when you have heat, soaring into the hundreds, 110s, tempers flare, and they've been flaring in the capital for a couple weeks now.
Anthony Shadid, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Anthony Shadid is a reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke to us from Baghdad.
By now, it's pretty well established that foods with a lot of animal fat, no matter how delicious they may be, are really not all that good for you. Well, here's more evidence of that as we head into this hamburgery holiday weekend. The Institute of Medicine, a nonprofit health advisory board, warns that cancer-causing dioxins accumulate in animal fat, which the study says should be a particular concern to women. Joining us on the line now is Dr. Robert Lawrence, Associate Dean of the Bloomberg School of Medicine at Johns Hopkins University. He chaired the Institute of Medicine committee that released the report. He joins us from Maine. Welcome, Doctor.
Thank you.
Well, Doctor, first, remind us, what are dioxins and why are they so dangerous?
Dioxins are organic chemicals. They're part of the group called persistent organic pollutants that stay around for a very long time. And they accumulate in fatty tissues.
Where do they come from, dioxins?
They come from two sources. One, they've been produced for eons by natural combustion, forest fires. Organic material combined with chlorine and heat produces dioxins. And then in the last 50 years or so, produced in large quantities through industrial production of PCBs and other chemicals used in industry.
And what do they end up in that's of danger to us?
They end up in the food supply, primarily entering the human body by the animal fats that we consume as part of our daily diet.
Of course, the problem with dioxins is that they are carcinogens, yes? They cause cancer.
In high doses, cases of industrial accidents and other large exposures, they have been shown to cause cancer in adults. And equally disturbing, they cause developmental delays in young children.
I see. Now, the study pinpoints women and girls in particular at risk for exposure to dioxins in fatty foods. Why are you focusing on women and girls?
Primarily because of the risk to the fetus and the young child from a neurodevelopmental perspective. So we think that if young girls and women before they become pregnant do everything they can to reduce exposure to dioxin, there will be less dioxin in their own fatty tissues to pass on through the placenta or through the breast milk to the nursing infant.
I see. So, of course, it's not good for men to be exposed to this kind of thing in animal fat either.
Not at all.
Yeah. Now, does that mean that none of us should have a hamburger off the grill this weekend?
No. We are adding another strong argument to follow the dietary guidelines from the Department of Agriculture. And they call for moderate intake of animal fats. No more than 30% of our total daily calories should be from fat, and no more than 10% of our total daily calorie intake should be from animal fat. So that still allows an occasional hamburger and an occasional steak and so forth, but it does mean we should cut back because the typical American now has about 37% of daily calories are from fat.
What other foods besides meat should you look out for?
Whole milk, cheeses made from whole milk, certain fatty fish. The fatty fish problem is a complex one because fatty fish are also good from a cardiovascular perspective because they contain omega-3 fatty acids. But we recommend that a couple of fish meals per week will maintain the cardiovascular benefit while not providing excess exposure to dioxin.
So moderation in everything.
Moderation in all things. Not a very exciting message, but it is the one that really happens to be true with regard to our diet.
Right. Dr. Robert Lawrence, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Robert Lawrence of Johns Hopkins University. He joined us from Maine. Well, the Bush administration and U.S. farm groups have reacted with dismay to a European law passed yesterday that will require all food to be labeled if it contains any genetically modified ingredients. Anti-genetic modification activists in Europe praised the new law as a victory for consumer choice. Now, the labeling regulations may lead to the lifting of an unofficial EU ban on genetically modified food. But it will also force farmers and the U.S. food industry to introduce expensive new procedures to track biotech ingredients in what they sell, or abandon much of the annual $6 billion European export market. Paul Dreisig is an agricultural trade specialist at DTB Associates, a consulting firm in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Fine, Paul. Thanks for joining us. Well, Paul, it was 5 years ago, seven European countries banned genetically modified foods. Now it looks like genetically modified foods will no longer be banned, but there will be labels. What's the problem with that?
Well, the first thing is I'm not convinced in my own mind that the ban will be lifted. We've seen over the last 5 years, virtually every year, proposals or actions taken by the Europeans that officials in Brussels will say to us means the lifting of the de facto ban or the moratorium on our products. But it doesn't happen.
How much of U.S. food exports are genetically modified?
Well, that's very hard to say because so much of the food products that we do produce and export now contain some genetically modified ingredients, starches and proteins and vegetable oils produced with corn and soybeans and canola and other products here in the United States may contain genetically modified products.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is what percentage potentially of U.S. food exports could have to be labeled as genetically modified?
Oh, wow. Again, I'm not sure that anybody's put a figure to it, but you mentioned at the outset that we export a little over $6 billion in agricultural products to the European Union now, and that's been in decline for about the last 4 or 5 years. But I would say that probably a good half of what we export could be at risk because of the additional costs and, in some cases, the absolute inability to comply with these new regulations.
What do you mean?
Well, there will be requirements that products be traced back to a farm in the United States. And for us, with our grain handling system, with our oilseed handling system here in this country, it may be technically impossible to identify from which farm a kernel of corn came from that ended up in processed food product, a cake mix or something that's sold in Europe.
So at the end of the day, will the U.S. food industry be able to introduce processes that will allow them to comply with the European requirements?
Well, I think the answer to that, you'd probably have to ask people in the food industry. I know they're extremely concerned about this. They are talking, along with people in the agriculture community, about seeking action by the United States government in the World Trade Organization to make this go away. That can't happen until it's actually implemented, and I'm afraid what we'll see is probably a significant amount of damage to our exports of food and agricultural products to Europe while this thing is being sorted out.
Paul Dreisig, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Paul Dreisig is an agricultural trade specialist at DTB Associates, a consulting firm in Washington, D.C.
Just ahead, should other countries surrender Americans to the International Criminal Court?
And later, the Capitol steps poke fun at politics.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young is off today.
And it's Here and Now.
This week, the United States announced it was cutting off military aid to 35 allies that have not signed special agreements with Washington, in which those countries would promise not to surrender U.S. citizens wanted by the International Criminal Court in The Hague. The dollar amounts aren't huge by the standards of the U.S. budget, about $48 million this fiscal year, and the savings certainly won't put much of a dent in the deficit, now close to $4 trillion. But allies that don't comply will lose considerably more money next year, and it may also threaten U.S. efforts to slow the drug trade or to contain civil wars in countries like Colombia. It all comes down to whether or not the United States should honor the authority of an international court. We've invited two people with very different views on that question. Anthony Aaron teaches international law at Georgetown University. Hi, Anthony.
Greetings.
And John Hulsman is a scholar at the Heritage Foundation. Hello, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. John, let's start with you, because this does sound like a pretty drastic step, particularly when you're talking about allies.
Well, I mean, I think we're redefining what the term ally means in the new era. As you say, the money, most of the money for fiscal 2003 of a military nature has already been distributed. The money suspended next year, however, could be substantially higher. And so one way to look at this is that this is a shot across the bow to a number of countries.
So what about that, Anthony? Is this a good idea or a bad idea?
Well, I think it's a very bad idea. And I think it's a bad idea because it's another example of the United States exercising unilateralism and trying to assert itself against other states in the international system rather than trying to work cooperatively with those states. I mean, my sense is there are certainly issues with the International Criminal Court statute, and there are problems which the United States has been trying to address. I think this is absolutely the wrong way to address those problems. It sends a signal when combined with other kinds of unilateral activities that are taking place that the United States really is being the bully, and we really are saying to the rest of the world, unless you're going to play by our rules and with our toys, we're going to take those toys and we're going to go home. And I think that's the wrong message to be sending.
Well, John, I want to give you a chance to argue that point if you
do.
Wish. But first, let's just back up a second and explain how we got here, because these cuts in aid were ordered by Congress in a law called the American Service Members Protection Act. Give us a quick rundown of what those agreements are about.
Well, basically, the agreements are about that if countries who are members of the ICC, the International Criminal Court, don't sign an Article 98 agreement, this non-surrender pact we've talked about, and by the way, 51 nations have signed Article 98 agreements with the United States. A number of our allies, however, have not. Countries like Brazil, Bulgaria, Colombia, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Slovakia, Slovenia have not signed these agreements. And it's a way for us to say that, look, we take this very seriously, and I can't think of a more stark contrast. It's not as enforcing our will on the rest of the world. Rather, it's us saying to the rest of the world, if Nauru and France and Belgium sign a treaty, that's fine, but don't expect that to be binding on the United States. I can't think of anything more arrogant or unilateral than that. If the United States Congress chooses to sign this agreement for good or for ill, I think that's one thing, but it's the United States saying we will not cede our national sovereignty in a country where the Constitution is the highest law of the land still, and where most Americans, frankly, in poll after poll, agree that that's the way they want things to be. I think that's a fundamental issue.
Well, I certainly don't see it as a case at all of sovereignty or the Constitution. We're talking about circumstances where American citizens would be abroad and how they would be treated once they're abroad. Now, my sense is that a couple things. First of all, when the American military goes abroad, they can sign status of forces agreements to cover those particular instances at those times. That, in my view, would be the preferred option, rather than having these blanket agreements forced on these other states. Because that's the unilateralism I see. It's that symbolic message that I think we're sending to the world.
And to me, the symbolic point, and I'd make four quick ones, is this is an unaccountable legal bureaucracy claiming the authority to arrest, prosecute, and punish nationals from any country accused of war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity. And this invites political manipulation.
Well,
we cannot guarantee, now do let me finish, we can't guarantee the checks and balances will indefinitely preclude politically motivated indictments. Let's look what Belgium's doing recently. This is a ceding of national sovereignty because the American Senate, right or wrong, has chosen not to ratify this agreement. And might I add, broad majorities of both Democrats and Republicans have agreed to this. This isn't a particularly partisan issue. Until the United States Senate agrees to the ICC, the notion that the rest of the world can say, even though your Senate, the political people who have been elected to make these decisions, have said no, we still are going to enforce this upon you. I can't think of anything more about power. This isn't about international law. This is about the power of who gets to make those decisions. And frankly, we still live in a world where the nation state makes those decisions, much as people may wish that that were not the case.
Well, first of all, it's not correct, I would say, to argue that this is about the American sovereignty. We're talking about what happens to American citizens when they are in other countries. Right now, when American citizens go abroad, they're subject to the laws of those countries, and the legal systems in those countries can indict people, can prosecute individuals. I actually think there are more procedural checks with the ICC than there are in the legal systems of many foreign countries. I actually think we're more secure if the individuals would be tried at the ICC, or at least through that procedure, than in Belgian courts, frankly.
And Anthony, I know that generally you think this is a bad idea, but there is one area that still concerns you.
Well, that's true. I'm not really worried about American military personnel abroad, because first of all, I don't believe they are committing war crimes or crimes against humanity. Secondly, we have a very good system under the Uniform Code of Military Justice to prosecute those people, which would satisfy the requirements under the ICC. The only concern I have, and I think this is a real concern, is individuals working for the Central Intelligence Agency under the Directorate of Operations who may be authorized pursuant to a presidential finding to conduct a covert action abroad, which is found out and which has certain implications which individuals might consider rising to the level of a war crime or a crime against humanity. When that happens now, there's bilateral diplomacy that takes place behind the scenes, and states can have a little more pressure exerted upon them. With the ICC, it could very well be that those individuals would be sent to the International Criminal Court, and the United States wouldn't be in a position to try those individuals domestically because they would be acting pursuant to domestic law. My sense is that is a remote possibility that that would happen, and the benefits of the treaty and of signing on outweigh those possibilities, and I think that could be dealt with at the time. But I think it's important to acknowledge that that is an area of concern.
Well, gentlemen, thank you both so much.
My pleasure.
Anthony Aaron teaches international law at Georgetown University. John Hulsman is a scholar at the Heritage Foundation. Tomorrow on Here and Now, our editorial roundtable on homeland security and your city or town.
We follow our week-long theme of civil liberties to the movies.
That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, one city implements a plan to crack down on gangs, but is it constitutional?
If I'm talking Spanish to my neighbor, I shouldn't have to fear that the police are going to come and chase me away because we've given them that right.
And the satirical troupe Capital Steps, they always find something to joke about, whether it's inside or outside the Beltway.
Korea, we've learned there are nukes in Korea.
These stories coming up here and now. I'm Marianne Nichols. The White House still hasn't made a decision on whether to send U.S. troops to Liberia, but the Bush administration says plans are being drawn up just in case. And the administration continues to call on Liberia's leader, Charles Taylor, to step down and leave the country. Secretary of State Colin Powell.
We believe stability will only come to the country with the departure of President Taylor. In some of the earlier negotiations that led to the ceasefire, he agreed that that would be an appropriate step to take, and we hope it's a step that he will take at the appropriate time.
Powell says he'll be speaking to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan about the situation in Liberia later today. 9 U.S. soldiers are wounded after 2 new attacks in Iraq. 3 soldiers were injured in an ambush on troops in Baghdad, and 6 others in an army truck were hurt in an explosion just west of the capital. And 3 Iraqis are dead after U.S. troops fired on an attacker who reportedly threw a grenade at them. Meantime, the Bush administration is offering a $25 million reward for information that leads to Saddam Hussein's capture or proves he's already dead. A top al-Qaeda figure who was wanted in connection with the suicide bombings in Saudi Arabia 2 months ago has been killed in an explosion. A Saudi Interior Ministry official says the death appears to be a suicide. The official says Turki Nasser al-Dandani, who was being pursued for his alleged involvement in the Riyadh attacks that killed 25 people, blew himself up in a northern Saudi province. Police are investigating a suspicious package found this morning in the trunk of a car near New York's LaGuardia Airport. Workers at the rental car agency also found a weapon in the car, which police said had a device attached to it. The rental car agency has been evacuated, but the airport continues to operate normally. President Bush is expressing concern about the nation's unemployment rate, which shot up to 6.4% in June, the highest level in more than 9 years. Although recent indicators point to an economy struggling toward recovery, the latest report from the Labor Department showed America's job market was very much in recession during the past 3 months. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are down. The Dow is down 47 points at 90.96, and the Nasdaq is off 6 points at 16.72. It's 33 minutes past the hour.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
All across America, a number of cities have instituted anti-gang ordinances to help fight crime. With an ordinance on the books, police can disperse and even arrest young people or adults who they suspect may be taking part in gang activity, even if they aren't actually breaking any laws at the moment. All this week, we've been looking at civil liberties. Today, we're examining how this latest attempt to fight crime may be encroaching on the First Amendment right to assemble. Here and Now producer April Peavy went to Somerville, Massachusetts, just north of Boston, to find out from a local alderman why the city thinks it needs an anti-gang ordinance.
My name is Bruce Desmond. I'm an alderman at large in the city of Somerville. I'm a father of 4 and have been involved in community activities for about 25 years now.
Now, you have been a supporter of what's been known as the anti-gang loitering ordinance. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, the ordinance itself came about because we had 2 handicapped minors that were raped in this park, actually right over here in this playground right here. And the 2 people that were arrested and convicted were gang members. And what we were having is different problems of people not even being able to walk down Broadway because while they were, they would be harassed. Some elderly ladies were spit upon. So Bill Roach, who was one of the aldermen in Somerville, had come up with this ordinance, and I really jumped on it quickly because the more I read about it and the more I researched it, it seemed to me to follow along the lines of what they did in New York City with their what Bill Bratton described as his broken windows theory of preventing crime, and that is stopping the small stuff before it turns into something major. With him, it was not allowing people to jump over turnstiles and not pay for the tolls, or if they were urinating in public. What they found was when they had arrested people for those minor crimes, they found many of them armed. And they were very successful in that way of hitting the small things and stopping the larger things from happening. So I thought it was a good idea for Somerville.
How would the ordinance work? For example, if I'm here in the park and I see what I consider to be a gang of four or five men, young boys, would I call the cops and have them arrested? Or
the ordinance works where if there is a group loitering in certain areas, now the police chief is the authority that will designate the areas that this ordinance could be used in. We have a gang unit in the city of Somerville now, and these police officers, and there might be four or five of them in the unit, they have been trained and schooled on identifying gang members. They are the only ones that can enact this ordinance. So at that point, a person from the gang unit would go down and say, now, there could be four or five people, but only one of them or two of them be a gang member. That's enough of a reason for the police officer to say, you're not allowed to hang around in this corner. I'm telling you now, you have to disperse. If they do not disperse, if they refuse, and the officer has to tell them again, then they are liable to be arrested.
Has there been any resistance?
There has been resistance. We had numerous public hearings on it. Members of the Latino community spoke against it. People from civil liberties spoke against it, just basing it on that it's a violation of a person's civil liberties rights to assemble. And I guess that's where the argument comes in on the civil liberties. Does someone have the right to stand there? Well, they do have that right under the law, but if it's proving harmful, that community should have a right to prevent that, to stop that, or to legislate against that from happening. So it's not unrealistic to think that a community shouldn't have the right to control things that could prove harmful to the community.
And that was Somerville Alderman Bruce Desmond speaking to Here and Now producer April Peavy about the city's controversial ordinance cracking down on gang activity, including loitering. One lawmaker concerned about that ordinance is State Senator Jarrett Barrios, whose district includes Somerville. Senator Barrios joins me now on the line. Hi, Senator.
How are you all today?
Very well, thanks. You just heard the alderman's reasons for wanting the legislature to approve this ordinance.
Yes.
What's your response?
Well, foremost, I think it's important to recognize the horrific nature of the crimes perpetrated by these gang members of a Salvadoran street gang. And we all want to prevent these sort of crimes, and we all want to do them in a way which discourages future criminal activity, and we want to give our police officers, our public safety officials, the tools to do just that. The question then becomes, what are the tools which are effective and, by the way, that are constitutional? Just today I received from the State Senate Counsel's Office their formal legal opinion on the Somerville ordinance, and they are quite clear, quite certain that it's unconstitutional. The reason they said it is unconstitutional is precisely because it delegates entirely to the beat police officer, the beat officer, the decision as to who is in a gang. If things worked, as Alderman Desmond described, there was an anti-gang unit which had the pictures and they went out and they could verify, then perhaps, if that was in the legislation, perhaps it would survive judicial scrutiny. But it doesn't. The only thing the ordinance asks us to do is give the city the ability to allow its police officers who think that three people standing together, one of whom might be in a gang or not, allow them to disperse those folks.
Well, Senator, let me ask you this. In your view, is there a better way for police to deal with gang activity?
There's very clearly a better way to deal with gang activity. First of all, we need to deal with gang activity. If we're going to deal with it
through legislation. Let's pass legislation that actually discourages and prevents gang activity, that allows us to go after the criminals, get them out of our communities. Moreover, you can do this in a way which respects individuals' constitutional rights. Rather than creating an unfettered right of a police officer to stop anybody on the street who they think might be a gang member, giving that police officer strict requirements, for example, going after gang recruitment, you have to have an intent requirement. That is, you have to know that that particular person is a member of a gang and that their intent was to recruit another person into the gang. Well, that's going to require a little work on the police officer's part, but at the end of the day, you're going to know the person you get was guilty, and you're going to know that you did it in a way, you went after him in a way which was constitutional, which protects all of us. If I'm talking Spanish to my neighbor, I shouldn't have to fear that the police are going to come and chase me away because we've given them that right. The police should have to, and the police officers, by the way, support this because it doesn't go to the heart of the matter. It doesn't prevent gang activity, and it sacrifices too many of our citizens' civil liberties.
Well, Senator, thank you very much.
Many thanks, Gail. Bye-bye.
Massachusetts State Senator Jarrett Berrios.
Tomorrow, we'll continue our conversation on civil liberties by going to the movies with some of Hollywood's greatest films.
And still to come today, poking fun at everything. With the satirical troupe The Capitol Steps, no one is safe.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Monday's story about the primary poll on the Internet by the Move On organization prompted listener Robert Meserve to send us this email. Your story struck me as very slanted, first characterizing the poll as unscientific and then concluding with various condescending remarks about its members. In my opinion, Move On is one of the few signs of life of an almost dormant voting public in the United States.
Yesterday's segment on mosquito trapping and how best to deal with the pesky creatures had our phone and email lines buzzing.
J.C. Lerman felt that our experts' suggestions were lacking in depth. While our guest recommended long sleeves and long pants, Mr. Lerman wants to know, what about protecting my neck, cheeks, and eyelids? He also felt that we should have mentioned what to do about mosquitoes breeding indoors, since the elderly, who are most likely to be affected by West Nile virus, might be less affluent and have houses without mosquito screens and with leaky plumbing.
The segment also inspired a listener to share her time-tested remedy for mosquito bites.
Hi, this is Mary Skalsgard. I have a time-proven, for me, solution. Once I've been bitten, I immediately put on white vinegar, and it neutralizes the venom in the bite, and I never have a mosquito bite. Thanks a lot. I love your show.
Thank you, Mary.
Well, listener Roger Morfitt points out a linguistic lapse. He writes, I'm impressed with Mr. Delaney's achievements, so I will accept that he had a temporary loss of memory when in last Wednesday's interview on the Fed rate change, he used the non-word irregardless. Please tell me it will never happen again. Well, Mr. Morfitt, regardless of the circumstances, I promise to be more careful.
Our coverage of the Middle East roadmap to peace this week sparked disparate reactions from two listeners. On Monday's show, we checked in with Alon Ben David, the national security correspondent for Israel's Channel 10. That segment elicited this response.
Hi, my name is Amy Smith, and I'm in Cambridge, and I'm just concerned about the coverage on today's Here and Now of the roadmap to peace, so-called, the way it's presenting the conflict. It is as if there's two equal forces, whereas one side has overwhelming military force, is like the fourth largest military in the world, has Apache helicopters, F-16s, tanks, armorized bulldozers, and the other side has, you know, a few explosives and some rocks, and is the one who has been occupied. So this kind of presentation takes you away from the ideals of ethical journalism, balance, and honesty.
In yesterday's segment on the peace plan, we interviewed Christian Science Monitor reporter Cameron Barr in Jerusalem. The interview prompted Arthur Rabin of Pennsylvania to send us this email. Your Christian Science Monitor reporter, who described the situation in Bethlehem and Gaza, told us how the Palestinians are suffering more than the Israelis from the current situation. I guess that having kids blown up on buses is a minor irritant compared to being held at a checkpoint.
And finally, listener Richard Baxter wants to know, where is the bar in Portsmouth, New Hampshire that has sea shanties? Well, Richard, it is the Press Room Restaurant on Daniel Street. Cheers.
Bottoms up. And as always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your name and how to pronounce it, phone number, and the town where you live.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Elena Newport and Bill Strauss of Washington, D.C. tell the following story. Back in 1981, it fell to them to cast the Senate Foreign Relations Committee Christmas Nativity play. They needed to find two wise men and a virgin to play the starring roles. And in all of Washington, it turns out they couldn't find anyone with sufficient real-life experience to play those particular roles. But the happy result of all that was that Elena and Bill were forced to themselves entertain that fun bunch, the Foreign Relations Committee, and the Capitol Steps were born, a group that to this day continues to thrive, somehow finding folly, absurdity, and even mendacity and downright pretentiousness amid all the earth-shattering decision-making and decision-makers of Washington, D.C. Have a listen.
Korea, 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 Korea,
Korea. We've learned there are nukes in Korea. Before opening my mouth, is it the North or South that's bad? Korea.
That's the Capitol Steps rendition of, you guessed it, Korea. But you know the tune, of course, as Maria from West Side Story. A cut from the group's 23rd album, Between Iraq and, you may have guessed this too, Between Iraq and a Hard Place. Here's another tune from the album.
Don't talk. Don't talk. Don't talk. Don't talk.
Oh, I'm on a roll. I still have sky high polls, but Democrats insist that things are bad.
Bad.
To keep all the headlines off economic deadlines, I took some advice from dear old dad. He told me, talk about Saddam much as you can. Talk about Saddam, my son. If you act now, they'll forget the doubt. So
talk. Walk like a man, talk about Saddam is the name of that song. And I'm happy to say that joining us in the studio now are two Capitol Steps, founding member Elena Newport and Mike Thornton, to discuss this wonderful and enduring group. Welcome to both of you.
Well, glad to be here. Yeah. I noticed we made fun of both mass annihilation and war.
How do you do that, Mike? I mean, that's the question. You walk an awful lot of fine lines. You know, Korea might just blow us up someday or blow up somebody else. Yeah. Saddam Hussein is a homicidal megalomaniac or whoever you want to characterize him. You managed to make both of them funny.
Well, I think George W.'s self-deprecating humor seems to help with that quite a bit.
He's a little bit easier.
Yeah, I know. We perform live almost every night, so the audience tells us pretty quickly.
He kind of sets himself up for you.
Yeah.
But Alina, when you're looking at something dead serious as Iraq and Saddam Hussein, I mean, what a delicate line to walk.
Well, you know, and it's odd because it's harder to do humor right now, but it's sort of more important in a weird way because people now come up to us after our show and they're like, "Oh, I was watching CNN all day and I really needed this." Whereas, you know, under Clinton, we were kind of redundant. I mean, you didn't really need comedians under Clinton.
It was really hard to keep ahead of the wave.
It's truth.
He
sort of set the humor agenda.
Yeah, people were, you know, the economy was humming along and the headlines were funny and, you know, you hardly needed comedy. But now you really need it, right?
Yeah, you need it, but it's got to be a little harder because the lines are a lot more delicate, the high wire act.
That's right.
People constantly tell us after shows that we thought you weren't going to be able to be funny at times like this, and you were funnier than ever, and we really needed it.
Let's hear another tune, also about two guys not normally associated with making us laugh. Let's listen to it.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Crossfire. Tonight, two men who have barely spoken in years, Yasser Arafat and Ariel Sharon.
You don't bring me flowers. You don't send me emails.
Elaine, is there anything you won't touch? For example, 9/11.
Well, that cut you just played is an example. Obviously, the Middle East is not funny in almost any way whatsoever. But in almost any serious situation, there's a politician or more than one politician that is certainly fair game. And you can go after the leaders that are either putting their foot in their mouth or, you know, whatever. They're in the spotlight by their own choosing.
There's always somebody trying to make hay out of a situation, even a horrible situation.
Absolutely.
Is that the trick?
Right. I think I remember the O.J. Case, like, you know, 10 years ago, that was just like all anybody was talking about. And it was a murder. So that wasn't funny. But then you had Cato Kalin and Johnny Cochran. And you sort of look for the players around the edge of a serious issue.
Now, you guys are beloved all over the country, but also very much in the nation's capital, where you often appear. And on this new CD, like all your CDs, you rip into a lot of well-known politicians. On this album, Tom Daschle, Condoleezza Rice, Bill Clinton.
Condoleezza, he will ask me.
Do you ever run into these people?
All the time.
Yeah, and what happens?
Well, we perform for five presidents, six if you count Hillary.
Actually, you know, one senator got really mad one time. He was at the show, and he came up. It was D'Amato from New York. He was really mad, and he came up to me, and I thought, uh-oh. And he says, he was mad because we didn't have a song about him.
Oh, my God.
See, because to him, the biggest insult was that we ignored him.
Yeah. There's no such thing as bad publicity except no publicity, right?
I said, well, get in a scandal. We'll consider it. And next thing I knew, there was some kind of grand jury investigation of some
sort. Did you ever push the envelope in a way that made you feel bad later?
I don't know if you remember, but a few years ago, there was a story about somebody who got in trouble because it was a road rage incident. He took a puppy and he threw it out a window, and the dog was hit by another car. So we wrote a song, and believe me, it was very anti-throwing puppies out a window. It was
we were
against throwing puppies out the window. But the audience would not laugh at that song. They would not. So we decided at that point, you cannot make jokes about puppies.
Yeah, but you can make jokes about wars
and
everything else. And the Pope,
and
you just never know.
Korea with nuclear bombs.
Yeah.
But no puppies.
But not puppies.
Hey, I'm a puppy lover. Don't get me wrong.
But it's not all politics. Let's hear a cut now from the new album that's about cruise ships.
Be our guest. Be our guest. Disney's cruise line is the best.
Though our voyages have been hampered by intestinal distress.
Lots of guests.
And the crew.
Keep on catching stomach flu.
Shuffleboard is now a sick game.
I thought poop deck was a nickname.
So do you see this in the Washington Post and you say, oh, there's a song in that? Is that how that works?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We're like, we get up in the morning and we're like funeral directors or car repossessors. We wait for something to happen to somebody that's bad. And then we just like go out and, you know, put it on the stage.
I think what people don't realize when they hear our group is that it's changing all the time.
Yeah.
And within 9 months or a year, the show has completely changed. It's pretty much recycled through. And every time something happens, Elena's writing a song about it. So it really keeps it fresh and keeps it fun.
Who's your favorite target these days? We mentioned the Clintons. They do come up, don't they?
The golden age.
Still. I think W must be at the top of the list these days, right?
But yeah. My personal favorite as one of the writers was always Ross Perot. Because, you know, it was with Ross, it was as a writer, how do you phrase something like what Ross would phrase it? I mean, most politicians would say the deficit's a serious issue. Well, Ross would have said, and I think we had him say, the deficit's like having a rattlesnake in your pants. You got to take out, you got to shoot it, but you don't want to hit nothing important.
Thanks so much to both of you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Elena Newport and Mike Thornton of the Capitol Steps joined us in the studio. And as we head into this Independence Day weekend, here's another track, and happy 4th of July.
Well, I've heard that other countries are down on the U.S., a land of mass consumption, our lives filled with excess. But my daddy wasn't fighting on Normandy that day for the right to drive a Hyundai. I refuse to live that way. And I'm proud to be an American who gets just 5 mpg. Though I live alone, the car I own can seat 103, and I'll gladly park so close to you when you pull out you can't see. No, I'll never trade my Escalade. God bless my SUV.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com. At mathworks.com.